Well, now, I'd just like to say, before you get a formal introduction to Mrs. Tuckman, that I think there have been four superb books of nonfiction published in this country within the last four or five years. I haven't read a new one. I haven't read David's book yet. But I did read her Guns of August. And I would say any literary society that can produce within 4 years four books like The Guns of August by Barbara Tuckman and The Making of a President by Teddy White and Arthur Schlesinger's 1,000 Days and Truman Capote's New in Cold Blood, those four books alone make me feel that America in the literary sense is doing okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In a note that precedes the extensive bibliography at the end of her glowingly good book about the era before the First World War, The Proud Tower, Barbara Tuckman refers to certain individual writers who were among her sources, men like Roland and Masterman and Trotsky, who, she says, illumine what is happening around them by a sudden flash of understanding, who have a mysterious ability to perceive, almost to feel, the historical meaning of the moment and to convey it in words. One of the reasons for Ms. Tuckman's preeminence as an historian is her ability, and in this art, as in all others, there is a certain mysterious sixth sense about it, to find, amid the vast documentation of history, to recognize and to integrate meaningfully into her own work these illuminatory words, these flashes of understanding. In The Proud Tower, the signs and portents of a society that had a rendezvous with doomsday are revealed as well in the dreams of poets and the harrowing facts of official reports, in the themes of playwrights and composers, and in the personal eccentricities of statesmen, in great public events like the Dreyfus case and the peace conferences and the Second Internationale, and in the fleeting intimacies of private life, the fads and fashions and fantasies of the social world. Ms. Tuckman, who won the Pulitzer Prize with The Guns of August, has written here a quite different kind of book, but one of equal power and perception. For the second time at these book and author luncheons, it's my pleasure to present one of America's leading historians, Mrs. Barbara Tuckman.
That was such a beautiful description of the book. It's much better than I could ever do it. I want to talk about a particular kind of writer, the historian, naturally. But the historian as a creative writer on the level of novelists and poets. Now, this whole speech from here on is going to sound very immodest, but I can't help that. I wonder why it is generally assumed that the creative process is the exclusive property of poets and novelists. I would like to suggest that the thought process that the historian applies to his subject matter is just as creative as the imagination that the novelist applies to his. And when it comes to writing as an art, is Gibbon necessarily less of an artist in words than, let's say, Dickens? Or Winston Churchill less so than William Faulkner or Sinclair Lewis? Trevelyan, that is, George Macaulay Trevelyan, the late professor of modern history at Cambridge and a great champion of history as literature rather than scientific history, said in a famous essay on his muse that history ideally should be the exposition of facts about the past in their full emotional and intellectual value to a wide public by the difficult art of literature. Notice wide public, by the way. Trevelyan always stressed writing for the general reader as opposed to writing just for fellow scholars, because he knew that when you write for the public, you have to be clear and you have to be interesting. And those two criteria are what make for good writing. He had no patience with the idea that only imaginative writing is literature. Novels, he pointed out, if they are bad enough, are not literature. While even pamphlets, if they're good enough, like those of Milton or Jonathan Swift or Edmund Burke, are. I think the difficult art of literature is a very fine phrase. And Trevelyan, being a dirt farmer in that field, knew what he was talking about. I have to admit that I have always felt like an artist when I work on a book, but I didn't think I ought to say so until someone else said it first. It's like waiting to be proposed to. But now that an occasional reviewer here and there has made the observation, I feel I can talk about it. I see no reason why this attribute should always be confined to writers of fiction and poetry, while the rest of us are lumped together under that despicable term, nonfiction, as if we were some sort of remainder. I don't feel like a non-something. I feel quite specific, and I wish I could find a name to cover our work in place of nonfiction. And in the hope of finding an antonym, I looked fiction up in the dictionary and found it defined as the product of imaginative fashioning as opposed to fact, truth, and reality. So I thought for a while of adopting FTR, standing for fact, truth, and reality, as my new term, but it's awkward to use. Writers of reality is the nearest I can come to what I want, but I can't very well call us realtors because that has been preempted. Although, as a matter of fact, I would like to, because real estate, when you come to think of it, is exactly the sphere that writers of nonfiction deal in, the real estate of man, of human conduct. I wish I could get it back from the dealers in land. Then the categories could be poets, novelists, and realtors. For the purposes of this talk, I'm going to try it out today, see how it goes. Of course, it leaves out philosophers who deal in something in between fact and imagination. Emerson, you know. But they'll just have to take care of themselves. I should add that I don't go entirely along with Webster's statement that fiction is what is distinct from fact, truth, and reality. Because good fiction, as opposed to junk, even if it has nothing to do with fact, is usually founded on reality and perceives truth, even more truly sometimes than some historians. It is exactly this quality of perceiving truth, extracting it from irrelevant surroundings and conveying it to the viewer, to the reader, or the viewer of a picture, which distinguishes the artist. What the artist has is an extra vision and an inner vision, plus the ability to express it. He supplies a view or an understanding that the viewer or reader would not have gained without the aid of the artist's creative vision. This is what Monet does, for example, with one of those shimmering rivers reflecting poplars, or El Greco in the stormy sky over Toledo. Or Jane Austen, compressing a whole society into Mr. and Mrs. Bennet and Lady Catherine and Mr. Darcy. We realtors, at least those who aspire to write literature, do the same thing. Lytton Strachey perceived a truth about Queen Victoria and the eminent Victorians, and the style and form which he created to portray it has changed the whole approach to biography since he wrote. Rachel Carson perceived truth in The Seashore. Thoreau about Walden Pond, de Tocqueville about America, Gibbon about Rome, Karl Marx about capital, Carlyle about the French Revolution. Their work is based on study, observation, and accumulation of fact. But does anyone suppose that these realtors did not make use of their imagination? Certainly they did. That's what gave them their extra vision. Art Buchwald, by the way, who started out as a ham but now often comes up with genuinely creative political satire. like his column yesterday on how Bobby Kennedy solved the transit strike. Is a realtor who has made himself a creative writer by exercising his imagination on observed fact. It may not be satire in the grand manner of Candide or Gulliver's Travels on the whole human condition, but it has that quality of being both perceptive and suggestive, which seems to me the mark of the artist. Trevelyan wrote that the best historian was he who combined knowledge of the evidence with the largest intellect, the warmest human sympathy, and the highest imaginative powers. The last two qualities are no different than those necessary to a great novelist. They are a necessary part of the historian's equipment because they are what enable him to understand the evidence he has collected. Imagination stretches the facts, extrapolates from them, so to speak, thus supplying an otherwise missing answer to the why of what happened. And sympathy is essential to the understanding of motive. Without sympathy and imagination, the historian can copy figures from a tax roll forever or count them by computer, as they do now, I understand. But he will never know or be able to portray the people who paid the taxes. When I say that I felt like an artist, I mean that I constantly found myself perceiving a historical truth, or at least what I believe was the truth, by seizing upon a suggestion, and then after careful gathering of the evidence, conveying it in turn to the reader, not by piling up a list of all the facts I've collected, which is the way of the PhD, but by exercising the artist's privilege of selection. Actually, the idea for this book evolved in that way from a number of such perceptions. First, there was the line I quoted in the last book, In the Guns, from the Belgian socialist poet, Emile Verhaeren, who after a lifetime as a pacifist, dedicated to the social and humanitarian ideals which were then believed to erase national lines, he found himself filled with hatred of the German invader and disillusioned in all he had formerly believed in. And yet, as he wrote, "Since it seems to me that in this state of hatred, my conscience becomes diminished, I dedicate these pages to the man I used to be." I was so moved by this. His confession seemed to me so poignant and so evocative of a whole vanished time and mood that it decided me to try to retrieve it. It led to the last chapter in The Proud Tower on the socialist, and to Jaurès as the authentic socialist, to his wonderful prophetic lines, "I summon the living, I mourn the dead," and to his assassination as the perfect and dramatically right ending for the book, both chronologically and symbolically. And then there was Lord Ribblesdale. I owe this to American Heritage, who back in October 1961 published a piece on Sargent and Whistler, which reproduced the Ribblesdale portrait in color. That acid note is from my publishers who wouldn't let me have color. In the Sargent portrait, Ribblesdale stared out upon the world, as I later wrote in the Proud Tower, in an attitude of such natural arrogance, elegance, and self-confidence as no man of a later day would ever again achieve. Here, too, was a vanished era which came together in my mind with Verhaeren's line, "The man I used to be," like two globules of mercury making a single mass. And from that came the idea for the book. And Ribblesdale was, of course, the suggestion that grew into the opening chapter on the patricians. This is the reward of having the artist's eye. It always leads you to the right thing. As I see it, there are three parts to the creative process. The first, that extra vision I've been talking about. Second, medium of expression. That is language for writers and paint for painters and clay for sculptors and so on. And third, design or structure. When it comes to language, nothing for a writer, I think, is more satisfying than writing a good sentence. It's no fun to write lumpishly and dully in prose a reader must plod through like wet sand. But it is a pleasure to achieve, if one can, a clear-running prose that is simple, yet full of surprises. But that doesn't just happen. It requires skill, hard work, a good ear, and continued practice, as much as it takes Heifetz to play the violin. The goals, as I have said, are clarity, interest, and aesthetic pleasure. On the first of these, I would like to quote Macaulay, a great historian and a great writer, who once wrote to a friend, "How little the all-important art of making meaning pellucid is studied now. Hardly any popular writer except myself thinks of it." I could talk all day about language, but I've got to get to structure. Now, my own form of structure or design is narrative, which is not every historian's, I may say. Indeed, it is considered rather old-fashioned now by the advanced academics. But I don't mind what they think, because no one could possibly persuade me that telling a story is not the most desirable thing a writer could do. But narrative history is neither as simple nor as straightforward as it might seem. It requires arrangement, composition, planning, just like a painting, like Rembrandt's Night Watch, for example. He didn't fit in all those figures with certain ones in the background and certain in the foreground and the light falling on them just so without trial and error and, I'm sure, many preliminary sketches. It's the same with writing history. Although the finished result may look to the reader natural and inevitable, as if the author had only to follow the sequence of events, it is not that easy, believe me. Sometimes events at different places are simultaneous in time, as in the Guns of August with the battles on the East and Western Front and at sea, and this raises a problem in sequence. Or in the Proud Tower, for instance, the two English chapters were originally conceived as one. I divided them and put them well apart in order to give a feeling of progression. I suppose this is a trade secret I shouldn't be telling, but anyway, of chronological movement to the book. Or the story of the anarchists, where their ideas and deeds set in counterpoint to each other, was a problem in arrangement. In the middle section of the Hague chapter on the Paris Exposition of 1900 was originally planned as a separate centerpiece, marking the turn of the century, until I saw it as a bridge linking the two conferences, where it now seems to belong. Structure is chiefly a problem of selection, an agonizing business because there's always more material than one can use in a story. The problem is how and what to select out of all that has happened, without, by the very process of selection, giving an over or under emphasis which violates the truth. One cannot put in everything, the result would be a shapeless mass. The job is to achieve narrative without straying from the essential facts or leaving out any essential facts, and without twisting the material to suit one's own convenience, which is a temptation. But if you do it with history, you invariably land in trouble. I've been tempted once or twice, and I know. The most difficult task of selection I had was in the Dreyfus chapter. To try to skip over all that business about the bordereau and the handwriting and the forgeries in order to focus on what happened to France, and yet at the same time give the reader enough information to enable him to understand what was going on, nearly drove me to despair. My writing slowed down to a trickle until one dreadful day when I went to my study at 9 a.m. and stayed there all day in a kind of blank coma until 5 that afternoon, when I emerged without having written a single word. It was frightening, I can tell you. There are other problems of structure peculiar to writing history. How to explain background and keep the story moving, how to create suspense and sustain interest in a narrative of which the outcome, like who won the war, to put it mildly, is known. If anyone thinks this does not take creative writing, he should try it. Mr. Capote's book, for example, which deals with real life like mine, is a marvel of conscious design. One can see him planning, arranging, composing his material until he achieves a perfectly balanced structure. That is art. Does he become less of a creative writer because he is dealing with fact instead of imagination? His method, however, is not really so new as he thinks. He is merely applying to contemporary material what historians have been doing for years. Herodotus started it more than 2,000 years ago, walking all over Asia Minor and asking questions. Francis Parkman went and lived among the Indians. Freeman, before he wrote The Norman Conquest, visited every spot the conqueror ever set foot on. Mr. Capote raises journalism to the level of literature. I have been trying to do it with history.